I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating book that looks at the history of Washington, D.C. And, of course, if you're looking at that history, you also have to look at what was going on after the Revolutionary War, fashioning the U.S. government, the Civil War, the construction of monuments, the role of race and poverty and demonstrations, and what the rest of the world thought of Washington, D.C. It's really a thorough book written, well, the title of it, by the way, is Washington, A History of Our National City. And the author is our guest this hour, Tom Lewis. He's professor emeritus of English at Skidmore College. He's a historian as well and author of four books, including The Hudson. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Any question you have about the history of D.C., he, I'm sure, is going to be able to answer this for you, and here is how you get a hold of us this hour. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter at K Dunn Show. I know that many of you have been to Washington. It's one of those cities I've always wished I lived in for some time because there is so much there. It's center of politics and so many things, but you've been there, I'm sure, so that you'll find this an interesting conversation. Tom, thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for writing the book. It's really, really interesting.
Thank you so much for your interest. I'm delighted to be on the show, and I'm delighted to talk with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So let's just talk about you as a little kid. You got interest. You lived in Philadelphia. You had relatives in Virginia, so you would drive through D.C., which started you becoming curious about D.C., right?
Absolutely. My father drove always. A 1946 Studebaker, and I would be in the back seat, and I was, at that age, I could actually stand up in the back seat. There weren't belts or anything like that. And so I stood up most of the way from Philadelphia to Virginia, and we always went through Washington, D.C., or we often did, and I always was fascinated coming in from Baltimore down New York Avenue to the city. And, of course, you can see the Washington Monument doing that way. And that was, in a sense, my first introduction to the city. And I always used to look forward to going back and seeing what was going on. And then I'd go to the library and I'd read about Washington and how it was, and there weren't many books, but there were a few books that would touch on Washington for younger readers, and so I would avidly get them out of the public library and read those. And then I became even more interested, and something sparked me actually in the eighth grade when I found out that Washington citizens didn't have the right to vote. And I challenged my history teacher at the time. I said, why is this? And he said, well, it's in the Constitution, which it is, that this should be a federal territory. And he said, it doesn't really matter because all the people who live in Washington go home to vote. They don't have another right. Which, of course, is wrong,
right,
since there were, at that time, about 800,000 people in the city. There are now 650,000 people. They have more people in Washington than there are in either Vermont or Wyoming. And yet, and Washington does indeed have some limited voting rights. It's allowed to vote for a president, but it has no representative in the United States Congress who has the right to vote, whereas, of course, every state in the Union has two senators and a number of Congress people. And we in Washington, we've made it so that Washington does not.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a terrible conundrum.
Well, as I recall in the book, you write about, and I can't remember the guy's name, there was only one person who really expressed strong objections to a district. Who was that?
You're really challenging me. That was a man who was in the New York State Legislature,
yes, yes.
And he was ratifying the Constitution. And I apologize, I don't have his name right on the tip of my tongue, but he is a man who said that this was going to make these people in Washington basically serfs.
Mm-hmm.
They would not have any rights. And of course, he pointed out the irony, and the irony is that here at the center of our democracy, no one who lives in the District of Columbia has any voting representation. That's why their license plates today say taxation without representation.
Fascinating. You start the book, Tom, with the open-air concert in front of the Lincoln Memorial, the contralto, the great singer Marian Anderson, who wasn't allowed inside Constitutional Hall, Eleanor Roosevelt giving up her membership in the DAR because they wouldn't let Marian Anderson in. As I was reading this, I thought, well, you could have started your book with George Washington, and you get very quickly into George Washington, but you started it with Marian Anderson, which I'm sure was a statement on your part, that it was significant you wrote about her first. Why?
Well, Washington has all, there were three real reasons. It has a lot to say about race. It has a great deal to say about governance, and it has a great deal to say about the fact that Washington is an important symbol. Mm. It's the symbol of our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And to take those just for a minute, race becomes obviously important because in Washington there was de facto segregation throughout the city. And in fact, a lot of it was not just de facto. It was actually written into the laws.
Mm-hmm.
There were covenants and restrictions about selling real estate. You couldn't sit in certain parts of the theater, theaters,
mm-hmm.
if you were black. And indeed, many of the theaters were white only. So there was, growing up in Washington, at the same time as whites were developing, so Washingtonians, black Washingtonians, were developing their own culture, their own theaters, their own places of worship and entertainment. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that at that time, in 1939, Washington had no real governance. It was, quote, governed, unquote, by three commissioners. So you had three commissioners in control of a city of 800,000 people. Now, that's kind of preposterous when you think that the commissioners were, other than there was one who was a military man always to look after the monuments, but the other two were basically presidential stooges. That is to say, good bridge playing and poker playing
buddies
of the president and that sort of thing. And the one who was in charge of the commissioner in charge at that time was a very nice, affable vegetable named John Russell Young. And his main job that year, which he was most proud of, was giving out certificates to safe drivers and to organizing the March of Dimes celebration for President Roosevelt. Worthy things, but not really the stuff of governance. And then
Before you go to number three, but didn't that go back, wasn't that the design of George Washington? So there was a precedent for these commissioners? Was it always so? We had three commissioners?
You're partially right, Irene. At the beginning, when they were building Washington, there were three commissioners who were in charge of the construction. They faded out by the time of Jefferson's administration. in 1801, excuse me. But what happened was after that they had an appointed mayor who then later became an elected mayor. And then after the Civil War, they decided, the Congress, that is, decided to make the city into a territory. So it had a territorial governor, so something like Guam, mm-hmm. Who was appointed by the president. Mm-hmm. And that led to a great deal of allegations of bribery and chicanery and fraud and the usual. And so starting in the mid-1870s, 1874, they decided to make put three commissioners in charge of the city. And so those commissioners were still operating at the time of Marian Anderson's concert. And they did, by the way, until the 1970s.
Mm. So I didn't mean to interrupt you.
100 years of commissioner rule. So now there's a city council and an elected city council and an elected mayor. Congress has allowed that.
Mm.
But it won't let the purse strings.
Mm-hmm.
I won't allow the citizens of the city of Washington to have control over the money.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. We have race, race, governance, and what's number three?
The third one is really the fact that it was a symbol. So here you had at the center of our democracy, writ large, not only for the United States, but for the world,
mm-hmm.
that the United States practiced segregation and would not allow the most important female singer in the world to use her voice in a segregated concert hall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was and so it became something that was very, very big. And what happened was, across the world, and what happened was member of the Roosevelt administration, the Secretary of Interior, decided to allow the concert to be held on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And what he said at the beginning, before the concert began, he said that freedom does not know a color. And Marian Anderson got up and sang, began her concert by singing, "My country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee we sing, not just I."
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very pointed change that she did, included in her program.
Mm-hmm. And that picture of her delivering her voice to the country, because people were listening on radio, and that memorial, I'm a huge Lincoln lover. There's something about that memorial that brings me to tears every time I see it. And you write about another reason you wrote the book, because you were reading the Gettysburg and part of the second inaugural at that memorial, and then went to the Vietnam Memorial to find the name of a dear friend you had lost in that war. And then you thought, so it was the genesis of this book, too, right?
Yes, it absolutely was. I was in Washington doing a lot of business in the 80s, and one night I wandered down and walked the entire mall. This was a time, by the way, when Washington was supposed to be very dangerous, which I have fortunately never found it to be, and went to the Lincoln Memorial. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and I looked at that sublime statue of Daniel Chester French's creation, and then did what I always do and had done before. It wasn't the first time. I read the second inaugural and the Gettysburg Address, which are incised on the stone on each side of the statue in the hall. And then walk down those steps into the darkness of the Vietnam Memorial. And at that time, it was still, our nightmare was still going on, as it still is, alas, for many. And there were many people at that memorial that evening weeping.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to my friend, who is, if you're familiar with the memorial, and I
yes.
know some of your listeners are, it's actually kind of a V-shaped incline into the earth. And it's almost like you're walking into Vietnam. I always think of knee-deep in the Big Muddy and going deeper and deeper into that. And it, as it happens, my friend is at the very center. His name is at the very center, or close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Symbolism, symbolism, symbolism. Let's go back to George Washington. I feel like I neglect George Washington. You reminded me again of all that this man accomplished in putting together our government. It's amazing. But let's talk about his seeing the future of this country in the waters of the Potomac. Why?
Well, you're absolutely right about one thing, that I think we all neglect Washington. And I think it's possibly because of Abraham Lincoln being such a towering figure and right at that moment of our
yes.
great national trauma,
mm-hmm.
our Iliad and our Odyssey of the Civil War. But at the same time, Washington is the one who established the country and had to get it going. Not only was he a victorious general, but he had to really get the country up and running. And he saw the future of the country, and this is why the waters of the Potomac are so important. He saw the future of the country not on the Atlantic Plateau. He looked west, and what he thought was, at the time, that the Potomac could actually be connected to the Ohio River by means of a canal, and that Washington then would be the place where a lot of goods from the West would come and pass through the Potomac on their way to Europe. And he saw Washington as becoming not only a center of government, but also a great emporium, if you will, of goods. Obviously, he was wrong in two things. The 18th century engineering couldn't create the canal that he envisioned and, in fact, had invested in. And Washington's growth really depended upon the fact of the city becoming a seat of government. Few people could have envisioned, though I think Washington was one of them, George Washington was one of them, the capital being as great as it was, as it is, and great in terms of size. He asked Madison and Monroe, Madison and Jefferson, excuse me, for their thoughts about what the capital should be. This was after the Congress had decided to create the capital on the Potomac, and after he had had decided, as was in the Residence Act of 1791, exactly where the capital should be and how large it should be. He asked Jefferson and Madison for their thoughts. Madison gave some general ideas of what a capital should be, what he had as his vision for it. But Jefferson not only gave his thoughts, but he put them in a drawing of the exact size of the capital, and it was to be about 20,000 people. There were going to be 1,200 acres of land, and you had a city, you had a town for 20,000, whereas Washington went out and got himself Peter L'Enfant to be his architect, who envisioned a city of 750,000.
Hmm.
And it's interesting to me that the capital itself And the great mall of the Capitol, looking down the Potomac, or looking up, I should say, the Potomac to the Lincoln Memorial, looks to the west, where Washington's thought the future of the country.
Interesting. Let's spend a little time talking about the highly interesting and maybe full of himself, Peter L'Enfant, who Washington picked. And I guess I wasn't aware of this story, that he designed his inaugural in New York City as well. Tell us his story, why Washington picked him, what indeed he designed, and how he just wound up kind of a pauper with, you know, clothes with no elbows and wandering the streets of D.C.
Well, as I'm sure all of your listeners are familiar with Washington's topography, that is to say, the streets that run diagonally. And that was the creation of Peter L'Enfant. Peter L'Enfant came to this country right after the start of the Revolution. And the first thing he did, he came as Pierre L'Enfant, and the first thing he did was to call himself Peter. He became an American through and through. And he was a mercurial fellow, to say the least. He was a brilliant designer. He designed, and he was a very good artist. He drew sketches of West Point on the Hudson. He also drew images of some of Washington's generals at Valley Forge. So, and don't forget, the French were very close and very important to the American cause in the war. And so after the war, he wrote a letter, and after the Constitution was ratified, he wrote a letter saying, I want to create the national city, and it should be a large city. It shouldn't just be a small one, and it should embrace all the democratic ideals. And he took Washington up to Jenkins Hill, which is Capitol Hill, and is the highest promontory in the city, and looked out over the city and said, this is where the Capitol should be, the people's house, he called it. And down on this other plot of land, and he pointed to the place where the White House is, this should be the place for the president's palace. But what he faced was his own, if you will, pompousness, and he faced that as a problem, and he was, in a way, his own worst enemy. He decided that Washington was the only person he'd answer to. And as I said earlier, Washington had created, had a name, three commissioners to see to the building of the city. He refused to have anything to do with those commissioners, and said he would answer only to George Washington. And then it came time for when the city to be laid out, and he was chopping down trees and taking down barns and houses and anything that was in the way of the people, of the streets that he envisioned for his grand city. And at that point, Washington had to fire him because he tore down the house of one of the commissioners, Daniel Carroll of Duddington. And he was dismissed at that point, and unfortunately, he became a complete pauper. Hamilton gave him some work to design the city of Paterson, New Jersey. He got another design commission or two, but he always walked off them because of his overpowering ego, which was greater than as high as the Empire State. It really was.
We need to pause for a moment. I got wrapped up in the conversation. We need to pause and we'll return. We're speaking this hour with the author of Washington, A History of Our National City. As you can see, it's more than just the monuments. It's the fascinating people who put together the city that is in many ways a symbol of who we are and who we could be, the very good about us and that which could be a whole lot better. Washington, A History of Our National City. Tom Lewis, Professor Emeritus of English at Skidmore College and author of a number of other books. We're welcoming phone calls as well. Our phone number for questions you may have about the layout of Washington or why it is that we have Washington, D.C. as our capital and what was happening during the Civil War years, during the torching of the Capitol in 1814 by the British, the relationship among Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton we have to get to. And, oh, there's just so much. The book is filled with incredibly rich history. What Charles Dickens had to say about Washington, D.C., too, and other visitors. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at KDunnShow. We'll get very soon to the construction of the Washington Monument, which is a story. I didn't realize how long it was held up by the Know Nothing Party. We'll hear that story and many others as we continue. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we're speaking with the author of the very, very interesting book, Washington, A History of Our National City. And we have phone calls coming in, so let's hop to some of those. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a question based on personal experience. In the 1970s, when I was a high school student, I was a Senate page for Senator Edward W. Burke of Massachusetts, who's the tribute question, who was the last African-American Republican senator.
Oh.
But my question is, when I lived in Washington, D.C. in the 70s, it was the government areas comprised of the government buildings, and it is, middle class, upper middle class, predominantly white, wealthy, and powerful, but it is surrounded by, an African-American urban ghetto. And I'd like your author to comment on what is the social, economic, and political history that has, and is it still the same today? I don't know. But what is the social, economic, and political forces that have resulted in that? When I remember that situation in the 70s.
And did you, before you go away, Jim, did you like your years as a page? It must have been fun. Oh, Jim is gone. I'm sorry. Well, I hope they were fun years. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, Jim raises a really good question, and that is, what is the composition of Washington, the racial composition of Washington? And at the time that Jim was serving for Senator Brooke, who was a wonderful senator, by the way, he was living in Washington at probably one of the worst years, and that was after the riots that followed the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968. And the city didn't really recover from the damage that was done in those riots until the 1990s.
Oh, my.
And it was a terribly long and painful time. And part of that was because of congressional neglect, which I suspect we might get to. But let's get back to Jim's question. The racial makeup at that time was, it had tipped into majority African-American population. And it was also, and I lived through that time very dramatically, it was also a pretty unpleasant time in terms of racial tension in the United States. Vietnam was still going on, and African-American young men were being drafted into the war in disproportionate numbers, and white guys could get out with a college deferment, and so it was a tough time of tensions throughout the country. But now I think what happened in Washington is, again, because it's the center of the country, it all got sort of came to a point right there.
Yeah.
The other part of Jim's question is, what's happening today? There are a couple of things that have happened that are actually very, very positive, though they do have their tensions associated with them. One is the rebuilding and the reopening up of many of the riot-torn areas in D.C. And these were in a place, in a neighborhood, which is predominantly called Shaw. And this is a area which was one of the last areas for the metro to arrive in. People thought that was racist in itself. It actually wasn't. There were engineering facts that got in the way. But Shaw became a very vibrant neighborhood and in some ways has helped to lead Washington back. And you're wondering, what's a subway have to do with that? The subway brought economic vitality. It aided in communication in the city in the same way that good roads aid in communication or that railroads did in the 19th century. The subway was every bit as important. The D.C. Metro was every bit as important then. And remains so, even though the metro, because of congressional neglect and federal neglect, is in dire straits right now. It's still a very important part of the fabric of the city. Whites began to return from the suburbs in the 1990s. And in the late 1990s, the population, which had dipped, by 1970, it was down into the 500,000s, is now at 650,000 people. So it's coming back. But there are tensions because many of those whites are moving into areas which were formerly black, marginal areas, and there are questions about things like gentrification.
Right.
Which there always are.
Yeah. Let's go back in time. We have so much to cover in the book. Thank you very much for the call, and we'll take more in a moment. I want to go back to, because I wasn't aware of the length of this protest and this violent action. Let's go back to 1852, one of the monuments that is so prominent, the Washington Monument, and you call 1852 one of the first acts of domestic terrorism.
It certainly was. And it's well, I shouldn't laugh about it, but it's almost an amusing story if it didn't have such racial and ethnic underpinnings to it. You are talking about, of course, is the Washington Monument. After George Washington died, people decided that maybe there should be a monument to him. But the Jefferson's administration and the Democrats, Republicans, the Democratic Republican Party that was in power, really didn't shied away from that. They weren't too happy about Washington by that time. So the father of our country kind of got sidelined. By the 1840s, that had changed, and by 1848, a private subscription had raised enough money, not very much, but enough money, to get started on the Washington Monument. And so in 1848, they did just that, and they began it. And they got up to about 150 feet in the monument. And a group of citizens who went by the name Know Nothings, they were a party, and they were virulently anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, anti-foreign, and pro-American, though they didn't quite understand what that meant. But they certainly were all of those things. They took over the monument. They kicked out in 1852 the clerk of the works, kicked him out, and declared they were going to build the monument themselves. And so they got up about three stories of three courses of the magnificent marble blocks, but the stone they used had actually been rejected for the monument because it wasn't good enough. And nevertheless, they did that, and in about 1857, they abandoned the project. And it wasn't until the administration of Rutherford B. Hayes in 1876 and 77 and 78 that people decided, Congress decided, that something should be done. It was simply a stump sitting on the Capitol Mall, and it was actually what was called the beef capital of the world at that point, because all of the cattle that were slaughtered to feed the troops during the Civil War ended up grazing around the Washington Monument, and they actually set up there an abattoir who did in the cattle and created the meat to feed the troops. All of that was, so it was really our national, kind of our shame in
yes.
a way.
Yes.
And it went on, and it wasn't until the Cleveland administration that they actually finished the monument in 1884.
Oh, George deserved better than that, didn't he?
I should say so, too.
We're welcoming phone calls for our guest, who is the author of a fascinating book on the history of our national city, Washington. Tom Lewis is our guest, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have this message from Cameron from Madison. Why were the founding fathers all Masons, and can you give us some history about the statue on Judicial Square next to the Capitol? I hope that's enough information.
I'm not sure I can give you information on the statue on Judicial Square because I can't recall it, but I can talk a little bit about the Masons. So many of the founding fathers were indeed Masons, and George Washington was the leader of the Masons, and their Mason trappings were very much in evidence in Washington. This is, so for example, when George Washington wanted to move the building of Washington, D.C. forward, he had a cornerstone laying ceremony that he presided over at on a corner of the United States Capitol. And this was an important symbolic moment for him. He had a Mason's apron, which he wore, and a Mason's trowel, which he used, and he actually mudded the stone for that with concrete for that ceremonial laying. And you can imagine what it must have been like for all of these Masons in medieval garb walking up the ruts through the ruts of Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol to lay the stone. There was a similar Mason ceremony after the actual dimensions of Washington were ascertained and all the mile markers and dimension markers were put into place. And at the conclusion of that, they had a ceremony which marked the first mile marker. Now, that's all very important, but I think that possibly the caller or the author of the question had some other thoughts behind it, and that were and that had to do with what is the Masonic symbolism that is in Washington. And a great deal has been written about that, both by people who are pro-Masons and people who believe that there are various nefarious designs in the Capitol. I could not find in my research any credibility for the designs. But that there was anything nefarious about them. But he is absolutely right, or she, the author of the question, that there were many Masons there.
Tom Lewis is our guest this hour. We have to get back to, we talked about Washington and the Potomac and his fondness and wanting a capital there. Was it Washington's decision to have our nation's capital in D.C.? What did James Madison have to say about it? What did Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton? They had an interesting meeting, which we'll hear about in D.C. But who made the decision, and was it a right decision? Was it a southern city? What kinds of problems did Abraham Lincoln face having the capital in where it is, with Virginia and Maryland slaveholding states? We'll talk about that and take more phone calls in the time that we have. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just to get back to why it's D.C., was it George Washington's decision? What did James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton have to do with it? I want you to talk about that meeting. But was it ultimately George Washington's decision, Tom?
It was ultimately George Washington's decision as to where to place the seat of government, as it was called, on the Potomac River. He was given essentially a 100-mile length of the river where he could place it, basically from the Anacostia way 100 miles to the west. He chose the present place of D.C. for a number of reasons. One of them was that he wanted to have it close at hand to himself when he retired from the presidency. And so he was very, and of course, he couldn't see it from the portico at Mount Vernon, he could look up the river and imagine it be where it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that was very important to him. It was to him the not just a symbol, but for the seat of government, for the new democracy, which many across the world believed would not survive the decade. But it was also the place where that government would function in all of its trappings would be there. And he'd seen enough of that in both New York, where the first capital of the United States was, and in Philadelphia. So he knew pretty well what the government was going to be by the time he retired.
Mm. And it must have been rather problematic. I know Madison wanted it in the South. Jefferson did as well. They wanted it in their home area. It must have been difficult, the location of D.C., for Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, it was tremendously difficult for him. Before Lincoln became president, he was a young congressman. He was actually at the cornerstone laying ceremony for the Washington Monument.
Oh.
But he was, he also saw, while he was in Washington, the slave pens that were really adjacent to the Capitol. And one was adjacent to his boarding house. So he could, as he describes, look out his window, as he sometimes did, and see slaves being marched through the streets to be sold down the river to the South, to the Deep South. and the actuarial figures on slaves who were sold there was awful, because a slave could survive moderately well, though let's not forget the fact of the matter that the person was enslaved,
mm-hmm.
moderately well physically in the northern part of the South. But the further you went into the South, the more it became like Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember Uncle Tom's Cabin, I suspect some of your listeners will, what happens, Uncle Tom has been in Virginia and has been sold to the South, to the plantation in the South, where, of course, he meets his end. So Lincoln had that, but there were very physical reasons why Lincoln was in trouble right away, because by the time of his election, or right after his election, the southern states began to secede. Virginia did not secede until after his election, after he was inaugurated president, he could have been, had Maryland seceded, the capital of the country could have been in the center of enemy territory. As it was on the edge of enemy territory. The situation was so grave when Lincoln became president that when he arrived, he had to go to the city. He had to go down the eastern seaboard through Baltimore. At Baltimore, they had to change trains. And actually, at that point, Lincoln actually had to be disguised as a sick gentleman in order to escape people who were plotting his murder in the city of Baltimore.
Right.
Even before he became president. And then once he became president, once the secession really got going, they at one point cut off Washington entirely. And the city was isolated for a few days before northern troops got through and broke through southern barriers and really help to save them.
Extraordinarily difficult time. Let's take one more call, running short on time. John is next. Hi, John.
Hi. I would like to say that Washington, D.C. is a nice place to visit. GE had a trade show there where I supported the MRI scanners on display, and I was able to see the National Shrine, which is a Catholic cathedral. It's the largest cathedral in the United States. And don't forget the Smithsonian Museum is there. I went there and bought some knickknacks. And, of course, I was able to see the Washington Monument.
Yes, it's a wonderful city to visit. The Smithsonian, we don't have time for the history of that. But it's an extraordinary city. We only have a minute left, Tom. Tell us something that we don't know at all about Washington, like the know-nothing in the Washington Monument. Is there something else that's a little-known fact?
Well, I guess if I wanted to remind us of anything, is that I subtitled the book Our National City.
Yes.
A History of Our National City. It belongs to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I had in mind, when I wrote that title, Frederick Douglass's words about the city, the great Frederick Douglass, who said in a speech about the city, "It belongs to us, and whether it is mean or majestic, whether arrayed in glory or covered with shame, we cannot but share its character and its destiny." And I think those are really important words, if you'll let me just say quickly, because I'm sorry to say that I think we've neglected that important charge that we all have, that it is our city, and we don't do it as much service as we should.
Thank you, Tom, so much for being with us. Wonderful book. Tom Lewis, author of Washington, A History of Our National City. Ken Burns has said about his book, no small compliment, Tom Lewis has written a comprehensive and intimate portrait of our national capital. It's a vivid example of the best kind of history, filled with fascinating characters and details and suffused with issues that seem all too contemporary. Bravo. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. James Fallows is with us, first hour of tomorrow's program, to respond to the president's last State of the Union address, which you will be able to hear tonight on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening.